Hello, and welcome to our latest Life with Insight podcast. I'm your host today, Christian Kaplan, Head of Specialty Markets and Macro Strategy at Equitable Distributors. Today's topic, we will be discussing the role of life insurance in implementing a sound asset location strategy for tax-efficient investing. Featuring, I'm delighted to say, Michael Finke, Professor of Wealth Management at the American College of Financial Services. Before we get started, let me provide you with some background on Michael. Michael Finke, PhD, Professor of Wealth Management, Director for the Granum Center for Financial Security, and the Frank M. Engel Distinguished Chair in Economic Security at the American College of Financial Services. He joined the college in June 2016, having served since 2006 as a professor and PhD coordinator in the Department of Personal Financial Planning at Texas Tech University. From 1999 through 2006, he served as the Director of Graduate Studies at the University of Missouri. Michael is a nationally renowned researcher with a focus on the value of financial advice, financial planning regulation, investments, and individual investor behavior. He was named to the 2012 Investment Advisor IA 25 list and the 2013 and 14 Investment News Power 20. His research conducted with fellow professor Wade Fow questioning the 4% rule of retirement planning was published in the Journal of Financial Planning and won the 2014 Montgomery Warshauer Award for Most Influential Article. He previously won the award with Thomas Langdon in 2013. He was also selected to present his research on financial literacy and aging at the 2015 MIT Center for Finance and Policy Conference. Michael has published more than 50 peer-reviewed articles and is widely quoted in many of the nation's leading consumer publications, including Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Time Magazine, and Money Magazine. He also has worked on white paper research projects for companies that include MetLife, Northwestern Mutual, One America, the Society of Actuaries, and TIAA. He received a doctorate in consumer economics from The Ohio State University in 1998, a doctorate in finance from the University of Missouri in 2011, and also was awarded his CFP in 2006. Such an impressive background, and we're privileged to have you here with us today, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's jump right in. We have lots to talk about, and I very much look forward to having you opine on some of these questions that we want to ask you. But perhaps we can start with, you've done a number of articles recently on whether stocks are overvalued. The question I have for you is, from your perspective, are they?
Well, it's a tough question to answer, right? After we've had the longest bull run in the history of the U.S. stock market, we're still in it, I think. It makes it, I think for a lot of younger advisors, it seems as if stocks are just a thing that only goes up in value. But the reality is that stocks have a fundamental value. The companies make profits, and those profits can either be reinvested or they can be sent back to shareholders in the form of dividends. So there is such a thing as a fair value for a stock. And compared to our best measures of valuation, which is the price of the stock as a multiple of its last average 10 years of earnings, stocks look pretty expensive when you look at the historical average. In fact, where we are right now is a bit over twice the historical average in terms of valuation. In fact, there's only been one other period where stocks were this expensive, and that was in the late 1990s. Things didn't work out very well for stocks then. And the question comes, how predictable are stock returns really? You know, they seem to just go up in value. So they seem to be the best investment for someone who's willing to take more risk. We can count on maybe 10% returns on stocks every year going forward. Well, the reality is actually stocks are pretty predictable. I did a study recently that got published in Advisor Perspectives where I looked at whether or not you can actually predict the 10-year return on stock investments on the S&P 500 based on that valuation metric today, based on the price as a function of 10-year earnings, also known as the Shiller PE ratio. And what I find is that today's valuation predicts 10-year returns with a 90% degree of accuracy. That's amazing. That's, you know, in fact, it's almost like you're stuck with whatever today's valuations are. I mean, if you think about how amazing that is, you take any month between 1995 and 2010, and you go forward 10 years exactly, the return that you get over those 10 years is almost exactly perfectly predicted by the valuation metric of the stock market in the month that you invested. So stocks returns are actually very predictable. And if you use today's valuations and that same model, that post-1995 model, what you see is a predicted return on the S&P 500 that's a little bit less than 3%, given what valuations look like right now. Now, they're not going to be exactly 3%, but there's a range of where they could be. And that range is pretty tight, around 3%. You know, maybe we'll get lucky and they're going to be 5 or 6%. Maybe we'll get unlucky and they'll be negative or even around 0%. Remember in 1999, when the stock market was very highly valued, early 2000, the 10-year return was negative on stocks. So that's possible. You know, stocks can go through an extended period where they basically tread water. And it looks like valuations are telling us that investors need to be prepared for the possibility that stocks over the next 10 years are not going to do what they did over the last 10 years.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment. And, you know, in that context, knowing kind of what the forward projectors are, you know, and we're effectively saying that where we sit today, stocks are, relatively speaking, expensive relative to history. Does that mean bonds may be a better investment at this juncture?
I'm going to preface this by saying that whenever I give a presentation in front of retirees, I always start it by saying, I'm sorry. I have no good news for you. It's just a really depressing market to be retiring into right now. And I mean it. You know, I think that there, when it comes to financial assets, we're in for a toughie. You know, people, what I see happening now is, first of all, when you invest in bonds, bonds are what's known as fixed income. So the income that you can receive from your bond investment today is fixed. It's set. You know, things will change the return that you actually receive from your bond investment. Interest rates affect the return that you get from your bond investment. When the bonds mature, what's known as the duration of the bond portfolio is going to affect the return that you actually get on your bond investment. But like just like stocks, the 10-year return on bonds is pretty predictable. So you're kind of stuck with whatever interest rates are right now, and they're really low. And the one thing you can do if you're a bond investor is try to what's known as reach for yield on bond investments. And what that means is that some bond investors may be tempted to invest in these higher yield bond categories. We've studied the success of that strategy in the past. And what we find is that, of course, you may see yields of 5, maybe 6% on some bond funds. But the reality is you won't get 5 or 6% because some of those companies are going to go out of business. And you may only get a third of that on average above whatever the Treasury is paying historically. But actually, spreads between risky bonds and safe bonds right now are also very narrow. And when they have been this narrow historically, those lowest rated bonds have actually done worse than Treasuries. So this temptation to reach for yield in bonds, I think is going to lead a lot of investors down the wrong path where, you know, they see what Treasury returns are today. They're too low. People think they're ridiculous. They try to get a higher return on risky bonds, but that return may not actually come to fruition, or they may go for long-term bonds. But of course, long-term bonds are risky in a very low interest rate environment. So if you think about bond investments right now, what is the upside? Well, the upside is potentially if you hold long-term bonds, if interest rates go down, your bond portfolio could go up in value. But that's getting to the point where it's hard to imagine interest rates getting much lower than they are right now. So it really does look like a market where there's not a whole lot of upside, a lot of potential downside if interest rates rise in the future, or if you invest in risky bonds and what we see is a much higher rate of default among those bonds. You know, there's no really great news. I hate to start out a podcast like this by just saying that the market is not in a good place and that investors need to accept the fact that returns are going to be lower in the future than they have been in the past. But my fear is that if people don't acknowledge that reality, they're going to be disappointed or they may not invest properly.
Or they may inadvertently be reaching for inordinate amount of unknown risk as a result, unbeknownst to them, perhaps, as a result. And there can be tears and heartache as a result of that as well, to your earlier point about compression of yields or higher yielding bonds, et cetera. So then a third alternative to discuss, you know, as a financial advisor looking for an appropriate, suitable asset allocation for clients with mixing in, but looking for some type of income or yield, as it were, could an advisor help clients by choosing higher yielding or higher dividend stocks as an alternative?
Well, that's listed by a lot of people as an alternative to investing in a low interest rate environment. Doesn't high dividend stocks, don't they provide a attractive alternative to fixed income investments? We did actually have a situation over the last week where the yields on treasuries surpassed the dividend yield on the S&P 500. So what we're seeing is that stock valuations are so high that the yields that you're getting, even from large cap stocks in the S&P 500, the yields are pretty low. So what you can do is you can try to find stocks that are paying high dividends. This is another very dangerous strategy. If they're paying a high dividend, that means that the price is probably pretty low. And if the price is pretty low, maybe it's not a great investment. A lot of companies will try to juice up their dividend as a way of attracting investor capital. But what we see is that over the last 10 years, especially, there has been evidence of an investor inflow into dividend paying stocks that's driven up the price of the dividends, high dividend category, to the point where, historically, high dividend stocks have not outperformed other stocks once you control for the type of companies that pay high dividends. So historically, high dividend stocks have been value type companies. And actually, if you look at the performance of value companies that pay higher dividends versus those that pay lower dividends, you actually see that the lower dividend stocks outperform, and especially when you consider the net performance after tax. Now, this is a little bit esoteric, but if the marginal tax rate on capital gains is exactly the same as the marginal tax rate on dividends, that does not mean that you're not going to experience a disadvantage from having to pay dividends over time. And especially if you're not going to be using that money for income, there is going to be a tax drag, because with capital gains, you actually get a higher return every year, the larger your capital gain is, net of taxes. But with a dividend, you have to pay taxes on that every year. So you're getting knocked 20% every year that you have to pay taxes on your dividend income. So it is a less tax efficient way to get income from your stock portfolio. Anybody can create income from a stock portfolio, whether it paid dividends or not, by simply selling shares of an equity portfolio. This is what's known in finance as the dividend irrelevance theorem. It doesn't matter whether the company reinvests their profits or whether they pay it out in dividends. You know, the valuation is going to be essentially the same, because when a firm pays a dividend, the value of that company goes down by exactly the amount of the dividend. So I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about dividend stocks. Like, what is this truly income in the same way that a bond or an income annuity can produce income? No, it's just really a forced sale of a share of your stock. And if that's true, then you really have to focus on the total return of your dividend portfolio. And what we've seen is that investors really don't gain much of an advantage by leaning towards high dividend stocks.
Yeah, that's a brilliant response to that. I appreciate that comment. You know, so if we're kind of shifting it more towards the perspective of a financial advisor and sort of what are they to do in this environment where we're saying, you know, stocks have a tendency to be overvalued by a number of traditional metrics. Bond yields are at historical lows and you know, probably carry more risk than what is reflected in the bond yields that are being offered in the marketplace. And a high dividend yielding kind of portfolio to generate additional total returns isn't necessarily the panacea that it's sometimes purported to be. You know, and we put all of that in the context of, okay, we expect bond returns and stock returns, stock both dividend yielding and non-dividend yielding stock returns to be lower in the future. What would be the answer if we're talking to a financial advisor and saying, what is a financial advisor to do, knowing that they have to position the portfolio appropriately, that's a suitable risk tolerance to the client's objectives, but facing this reality that returns are going to be probably muted for the next decade or two. How do we kind of reposition their paradigm and how do we help them? Is it maybe perhaps to focus on certain other aspects of financial planning?
First of all, I'd like to say that is great to sort of reiterate that you maintain a portfolio that is consistent with their risk tolerance. You don't try to reach for greater risk because the market is not giving you much right now. That's a mistake that you can make because you may not get rewarded for taking that risk. And if risk is real, there's a potential downside of taking too much risk. And this is one of the things that I fear among retirees is, and I've actually looked at the data of younger baby boom, near retirees and retirees, they've invested a lot of their savings in equities. And what happens, especially at the beginning of retirement, if you get unlucky and equities end up falling by 30 or 40%, that's going to have a big impact on your ability to maintain a lifestyle. And ultimately, that's what it's all about. It's about how do you translate your money into a lifestyle. Now, that said, if you're going to maintain a proper asset allocation in an environment that is not giving you as much return, you have to figure out how that affects your financial plan. How that affects your financial plan mainly is that you need to save more. And what I like to tell people is that, in a low asset return environment, everything is worse. You have to save more during your working years, which means you spend less today. The money grows at a lower rate. And by the time you get to retirement, you have to have more money saved to get the same amount of income. So if you're a saver, lower returns are not that great, but you need to accept that reality because if you don't accept the reality, you're going to end up at retirement unprepared. Few people are unhappy that they save too much. Many people would be unhappy if they didn't save enough. So make sure that, one of the challenges is that there's always someone telling your client that they can, if they just invest in my mutual funds, then you're going to be able to get a sure 12% return on your stocks over time. That kind of a message is tough to fight against, but it's simply not reality. So, your job is not to put a pretty face on something that isn't real. Your job is to accept reality and then create a plan that is most likely to do well given the situation that we're in right now. So I think it simply changes some of the dynamics of optimal saving and optimal spending. It means that you probably are going to have to save more. But in the long run, your client's going to thank you, especially if we have an extended low return environment, because they're actually going to be able to retire on time.
Yeah. So in that vein, sort of practice more goal-based investing and focus. It might be tied to that. So in the context of this reality and working with financial advisors on sort of best practices under the circumstances, in the low return environment, what areas would you suggest a financial advisor focus on to deliver real value now that we're sort of faced with the reality that the return component of the portfolio and their job, as it were, to generate return is going to be muted? What other areas can they focus on?
I think a great example is March of last year, late February and March of last year. There are a lot of advisors I know who have spent years prepping their clients for a March type of event, telling them it's going to come eventually. And when it comes, here's what we're going to do. We're going to, if the stock market falls, we're going to rebalance back into equities to maintain our asset allocation. It's going to hurt, but you need to prepare yourself for it. And those advisors who I think prepped their clients and did whatever it took, reminded them that they have secure savings either in bonds or in life insurance or annuities. You've got that bedrock foundation that you can rely on in a worst case type of scenario. We can afford to maintain risk in the remainder of our investment portfolio. And those advisors who were able to successfully transition their clients through that very short bear market that occurred in late February and early March, they were in a much better position right now than those who pulled money out of risky assets. That's the kind of value that you can provide. If you think about those two clients, one of whom didn't have the right financial advisor and made a big mistake, and the other one who did have a financial advisor who could help them control their emotions, that one is in far better position right now. If you want to talk about a value proposition, that's a pretty extreme example of a value that you provide your client. Now, the other way that you can provide value is by paying attention to taxation. All signals are pointing towards higher taxation in the future, whether it's taxation on capital gains or I think taxation on dividends are highly vulnerable. You may see state tax rates going up. Protecting your client against the risk of potential increases in taxation and paying close attention to how you're locating assets within different types of accounts, whether it's a traditional IRA or a Roth account or a taxable account, how can you generate the highest after-tax return in an environment in which taxes may be rising in the future? That's another quantifiable source of value that you can provide, even if returns are not that great, taking advantage of after-tax returns in opportunities in the long run to juice those returns by tax-efficient investing. That's a true way you can generate more return for the exact same amount of risk from your investment portfolio.
Very interesting. And sort of going back to this idea of practicing goal-based investing that I mentioned earlier, could you provide the audience a little bit of an overview of what is goal-based investing and potentially why is it better?
And this is one of the things that we teach in our Wealth Management Certified Professional Program is a goal-based investing approach. And what that means is that you begin the investment process with the goal, the spending goal in mind. I mean, either a legacy or a spending goal. And then you pick a path that's going to allow you to achieve the highest after-tax returns for the amount of risk that you're willing to take when it comes to that goal. There's a lot of things that are related to that concept of goal investing that I think are powerful. The first is, it helps you understand the amount of risk that you're really willing to take with those investments. So if you sit down with a client and you say, all right, how much risk are you willing to take with the goal of saving for your child's education in 12 years? They can articulate that. They can say, well, you know, I'm willing to take more risk so that I have more money available to help support my kids' education. If the market doesn't do as well, then I'm okay with that. I can be somewhat flexible. Or you may have a goal, for example, when you're saving for retirement, there's a certain amount of your expenses that should not be subject to a whole lot of risk. You have to fund some of those basic expenses. For that chunk of your retirement savings, you should take less risk with that because you can be less flexible. It's about characterizing risk as investment flexibility. That's part of the value of using a goal-based approach. The other value is that you have a time horizon, and the time horizon can dictate the value of different type of asset location strategies. For example, when you're deciding between a Roth and a traditional IRA, what is your marginal tax rate today? What is your marginal tax rate going to be in the future when you actually spend that money? Can we estimate the net return from different types of asset location approaches? We actually have an exercise in our wealth management program where you have money in different types of accounts and different types of investments, and you have to click on the investment and drop it into the right bucket, whether it's a Roth or a traditional or a taxable type of account, to generate the highest after-tax return. And then we run a simulation and we show you how close to optimal that is. And in many cases, by following that sort of tax-efficient asset location-based framework, you can generate, 50, 75 basis points of extra return simply by choosing the right account strategy. So that's another advantage of using a goal-based approach. And the final advantage is the behavioral aspect of using a goal-based approach. Because if you sit down and the client tells you they want to be able to spend $50,000 a year above Social Security in retirement, they have now articulated that goal. They own it. And when you own something, if you fail to meet that goal, it creates a lot of dissatisfaction. You're actually using behavioral finance to the client's advantage by taking advantage of loss aversion. Once you establish a goal, you lose if you fail to meet that goal. that motivates people to save more, to stay on track, to develop the right habits for being able to meet their long-term goals. I mean, if a goal is just a number, it's not that motivating. But if the goal is a lifestyle, that's motivating. And the failure to meet the goal means that I don't get to live the lifestyle I want to live. I don't get to save as much for my kids' education as I want to be able to save. Then you're going to be very disappointed if you fail to meet that goal.
That's fascinating. You know, it's another way to kind of define and help characterize kind of subjective interpretations of risk, would you say?
It is. Yeah. You know, this, what I find in my research is risk tolerance is a toughie. We actually looked at data from a company that tried to assess risk tolerance. And what we found was that, you know, it's not that stable of a characteristic, that there are periods where investors feel like they want to take more risk. There are periods like March of 2020 where investors feel like they want to take less risk. And, you know, using that sort of goal-based framework, I think it allows the client to put emotion around risk that, you know, during a period like March, if they pull out, they're not going to be able to meet their goal. They can withstand a greater amount of risk if it's associated with a specific goal.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. I want to return because you started broaching the subject very effectively, this idea around asset location, an advisor's ability to kind of manage potential present, ongoing, and future tax exposure, if you will, determining where assets are located, et cetera. I want to return to that for a moment here. Can you perhaps redefine by me asking you, what are the basic principles of tax efficient investing?
I have to start out by remembering that the only return that matters is the return after tax. That's the only return that you can actually spend. So when we're judging which type of asset location strategy is most effective, what we have to do is we have to focus on how much did your after-tax savings grow from when you initially invested it to when you spend it. And that's why we focus on this concept of net return. I'm going to start out by giving a very simple example. And that is if you have money in a money market account and you were to earn 4% on it and you were in a 40% income tax bracket, you would get a net return of 2.4%. Now, if you were to instead save the money in a traditional IRA at whatever your marginal tax rate is today, you're going to get to save at 4%, but then the net return is going to get whacked down whenever you spend the money. But if you look at the extra return that you generate, what you see is that it's going to be close to 4% over time. When you compare that to a Roth, what you see is that you're going to get, if marginal tax rates today and in the future are exactly the same, you're going to get the exact same return from using a Roth as you would from a traditional. Now, why would you choose a Roth? Well, you would choose a Roth if there was differential taxation, meaning if tax rates today are lower than they are in the future, then you're going to get a higher net return from investing in a Roth. If tax rates today are higher than they're going to be in your future, then a traditional is going to give you a higher net return. So differential taxation matters, time horizon matters. The other wrinkle is what I like to call basis assets. Basis assets are taxed at capital gains rates. And the unusual feature of a basis asset is that in the first year of investment, the difference between the gross return and the net return is exactly equal to the capital gains tax rate. But if you hold it 2 years, your net return is going to be a little higher. If you hold it 10 years, your return is going to be even higher than that. You get that because of the tax deferral benefit from holding a capital gains asset. It can be significant over the course of a 20-year time period. You can go from a 3.2% rate of return on a 4% gross asset after 1 year to close to 3.7% after 20 years from holding that asset for an additional year. Understanding that can allow you to better understand why it makes more sense in retirement, for example, to spend down your low capital gains assets first, which is not what a client wants to do at all. They want to spend the investments where they've made a lot of money. They want to cash in on those investments. But the reality is that to maximize net return, you need to spend those lower capital gains assets first. The other point I want to make is that insurance products act like a basis asset. You get the same type of tax deferral benefit as you would from a basis type of tax strategy. So I like to call life insurance and annuities basis type assets. And they become incredibly valuable when you have a highly tax inefficient asset and you house them within that basis type of structure. So essentially, can you turn like a high yield bond, fixed income? Can you turn a REIT? Can you turn a active equity type of strategy that's very tax inefficient into something that over the long run is more tax efficient? You can do it using an insurance type of structure. And that's where those insurance types of wrappers really shine, is when you're using a net return environment, thinking of them as if they're housing some of your least tax efficient assets in order to maximize the net return that you're going to receive over time.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And would you say then that an insurance vehicle or an annuity type vehicle, terms of, because you mentioned, you know, you like to think of them as basis type assets, would you go as far as to confirm that it would look an awful lot like a Roth-like instrument if it were available? And in the context of being able to then hedge future unknowns as far as taxation, obviously, it's a net benefit to the client, because if taxes are going to be higher in the future, having more of your assets inside one of these vehicles would be beneficial, because you're avoiding potentially, or you're hedging that future tax rate. Am I correct in making such a statement?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So for example, a life insurance product is basically like a Roth if you hold it until death. And you can borrow against it. You know, you have a lot of flexibility with an asset like that. It is a way of providing your client with tax deferral opportunities that will only grow in value as tax rates go up. So it's a good way to house assets to protect them from taxation. I want to make a point about annuities, because I think it's not well understood among those who use annuities as a tax sheltered instrument. One of the common criticisms of annuities is that they're not a terribly effective sheltering instrument for equities. Well, it's only really true for low dividend equities that are passive, but for other types of equity strategies, they can be more efficient. And the other way to efficiently use annuities is, unlike a life insurance product, which is really more efficient the longer you hold it, if you can use it as an asset of last resort, it becomes the most efficient type of structure, or more efficient type of structure. With an annuity, you actually get more tax efficiency by annuitizing it. So there is what's known as an exclusion ratio, which adds an additional tax deferral benefit. And what I found in my research is that the best way to use an annuity instrument is to use it as a way of accumulating, using tax inefficient assets, and at some point, then taking the wealth that you've accumulated in the annuity and getting an additional tax deferral benefit by turning it into income. And I don't think that's considered enough among advisors who have clients who've built significant wealth within the annuity structure, but you should consider at some point turning it into income, that you're going to get that benefit that you do from the exclusion ratio. And there's an important element of the exclusion ratio that I think is important to understand as well. And that is that when the IRS expects you to be dead on average, you're going to lose that tax deferral benefit. So what will happen is that your after-tax income is going to drop somewhat after a certain age. You need to be prepared for that. Your client needs to be prepared for that. It shouldn't be a big deal, but because by the time they get to be that age, it's quite likely that they're not spending as much money. And you might be able to set up a different type of annuity structure to be able to supplement that income at a later date. I'm a huge fan of qualified longevity annuity contracts, QLACs, because you can take some money from your IRA and then build a layer of income later on in life. You know, I'm also a big fan of automating your income later on in life, because I don't think it's a great idea to have a 95-year-old managing their own investments and deciding how much money to pull out of it every year. And that's a way of automating later life income, is through annuitization. But give some thought to when it is most efficient to use that type of a strategy.
Yeah, and I've heard and seen in several places over the last decade or two pointing out that people generally, especially at older ages, are happier if they have a defined amount of cash flow that's projected and sort of even guaranteed, ideally, of course. But knowing how much you can spend per month is easier for your average retiree rather than having a large pot of money and trying to figure out year by year how much to take out while still sustaining the principal balance or maintaining it for longevity purposes. Thank you, Michael. I want to sort of finish off with one last question, if you don't mind. And that's really goes to the heart of your background and what you do each and every day. But how can advisors learn more about being a better wealth manager? How can they take part and learn more about the things that you have spoken about today?
Well, we've created a new wealth management education program at the American College. It is focused on providing just this type of advice that I talked about today, which is creating knowledge that gives advisors the greatest opportunity to provide value for the client using a real science-based approach to wealth management that's most likely to create value through things like asset location, tax-efficient investing, taking advantage of behavioral phenomenon, using a goal-based approach. When we created what's known as the Wealth Management Certified Professional or the WMCP, we wanted to start over when it comes to wealth management education and focus on those areas where you can provide the greatest value. And I think one of the good things about the WMCP is that we've tried to edit down the content to only focus on the things that are most relevant to your practice. And we provide it in bite-sized chunks. So, you know, most of each chunk of content is no more than 5 minutes long, whether it's a video or a piece of text, you can get through it relatively quickly. You can probably get through the WMCP in somewhere between 6 to 8 months. But by the time you get to the end of the program, your ability to be an effective wealth manager is going to be far greater than another educational program that may take 2 or 3 years. But is not so focused specifically on these areas where you can provide the greatest value. I think it is, of all the educational programs in wealth management I've seen, the most in-depth content on tax-efficient investing, on different types of financial products, understanding the ins and outs of complex financial products, using Morningstar data to show how well they've performed in the past, using a goal-based framework, using a life cycle framework that allows you to integrate investments and insurance. That's a new approach to wealth management, but we think the right approach for most advisors.
Well, great discussion, Michael. We appreciate you being here to discuss the concept of risk and tax-efficient investing, and especially how life insurance fits in as tax-sheltering vehicles in a client's portfolio. I know our listeners have gotten a wealth of information from you today, and I know I have as well. Thanks again for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in today. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast series so you don't miss any of our presentations. And I look forward to having you joining us on our next Life with Insight podcast. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks so much.
Please be advised that this podcast is not intended as legal or tax advice. Accordingly, any tax information provided in this article is not intended or written to be used and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. The tax information was written to support the promotion or marketing of the transactions or matters addressed, and clients should seek advice based on their circumstances from an independent tax advisor. Neither Equitable Financial, Equitable Financial Life Insurance Company of America, Equitable Advisors, Equitable Network, nor Equitable Distributors provide legal or tax advice. Life insurance products are issued by Equitable Financial Life Insurance Company, New York, New York, or Equitable Financial Life Insurance Company of America and Arizona Stock Corporation, with its main administration office in Jersey City, New Jersey, 07310, and are co-distributed by Equitable Network, LLC, Equitable Network Insurance Agency of California in California, Equitable Network Insurance Agency of Utah in Utah, Equitable Network of Puerto Rico Incorporated in Puerto Rico, and Equitable Distributors LLC. Variable products are co-distributed by Equitable Advisors LLC, member FINRA and SIPC, Equitable Financial Advisors in Michigan and Tennessee, and Equitable Distributors LLC. When sold by New York-based, that is, domiciled financial professionals, life insurance products are issued by Equitable Financial Life Insurance Company, New York, New York. Equitable is the brand name of the retirement and protection subsidiaries of Equitable Holdings Incorporated, including Equitable Financial Life Insurance Company, New York, New York, Equitable Financial Life Insurance Company of America, an Arizona stock company with main administrative headquarters in Jersey City, New Jersey, and Equitable Distributors, LLC. Equitable Advisors is the brand name of Equitable Advisors, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, Equitable Financial Advisors in Michigan and Tennessee. While there are similarities between a Roth IRA and cash value life insurance, there are also differences. A Roth IRA is an IRS plan designed to facilitate retirement savings. Cash value life insurance is a contract that builds value and provides a death benefit backed by the claims-paying abilities of the issuing life insurance company. Carefully review all the features, benefits, and costs of a cash value life insurance policy with your client. If your client's life insurance policy lapses, they will lose the death benefit and may lose substantial money in the early years. To be effective, you need to hold the policy until death. A life insurance policy generally takes years to build up a substantial cash value. Tax-free distributions will reduce the cash value and face amount of the policy. Clients may need to pay higher premiums in the later years to keep the policy from lapsing. Clients must qualify medically and financially for life insurance, unlike the Roth IRA.